It's Darren Winston's Book Report. Sentiment, sentiment, sentiment. Sometimes it's hard. Sometimes, you know, if you love something, it's more valuable to you, obviously. And if you take some, if you bring it along to someone like you, you say, this is my precious something. And you have to say, that's great.
And but, sometimes, but, right. Well, the what brought us to your comment is this idea that, you know, people know that if a book is signed by the author, it tends to be more valuable. That's pretty much a truth. And if it's if it's a James Joyce, then it's much more valuable. And if it's a total nobody, sometimes it doesn't matter because no one's buying it. But one interesting area of, I guess, collecting is books that belonged to people of note. And that could be another author, it could be a movie star, it could be a politician. And very basically, you look at a book, it has a signature in the front, and it says, you know, Harry Truman, 1947 or something. And I'm making that example up, but it's a good example in that the people who are buying these books, the ones that have something in common, are buying a little piece of history. They think, I have this thing that Harry Truman had. It was on his bookshelf, might have been in the White House. He might have had it during some important talk. It might have been a gift from someone else. And if we know who the gift was from, we can start to put together a bit of a puzzle from that one giant piece, the other pieces being the provenance. Okay, it was signed by, you know, it was inscribed to Truman by somebody, and that somebody happened to have worked on a campaign of his, but those two guys served together in the First World War, and they came from the same town, and you can sort of reanimate a story that was never really set down as a story because it was just a bunch of stuff that happened in a sort of disconnected
way. Details,
yeah, exactly.
And then you literally weave a narrative out of it. And you and I have discussed this in the past based on ephemera that comes out of books where you go, oh, my gosh, this is a ticket on a cruise line. You know, this is a ticket on the Lusitania.
Right.
So, therefore, you know,
it's tied to history. Like, I had an example of that where, not to digress, but that's what we do. I was walking along East 63rd Street near where I used to live, and there was an old suitcase out on the curb with the garbage. And it was not leather. It was not canvas. It was a sort of hard substance. I can't remember what, but it dated from about the 40s. And it had some stickers on the side, like they do. And I picked it up. And it wasn't disgusting. It didn't have sort of banana peels all over it. And it didn't smell. And I thought, okay, I can take this home. And then I saw this sticker that it had been on the Andrea Doria at some point. I thought, oh, okay, that story ends really badly. But here's
a there were a couple of...
Right. So right. so this bag, the owner had been on that ship and gotten off it safely, presumably. And I had this tiny little piece of history. And when anybody would ask, I would say, oh, that suitcase was on the Andrea Doria. And like your point, someone that had been on the Lusitania or had some connection to it. And what started this was this fictional Harry Truman book. The fact is, I get books all the time that belonged to famous people. And in some cases, you can put together this great story. In some cases, like I have a book now that belonged to Gerald Murphy. And Murphy and his wife, Sarah, were friends of the Fitzgeralds. They were contemporaries of theirs. He was an artist. I think his family were the Mark Cross Leather Company. Lots of money. Interesting, they lived in Europe, I guess, between the wars and Cap Antibes. And there's a book, great book actually by Calvin Tompkins called Living Well is the Best Revenge, and it's about the Murphys. Anyway, I have a copy of a T.S. Eliot book that belonged to him, and it has his, I think it says something like Gerald Murphy, has the date, and might say New York City. And because of the date, we can figure out exactly where he was at the time, if that's important. And I'm flipping through it, and out comes a sort of, it's not really a flyer, a card for a Chinese laundry that was on Long Island. And this just happened, so I don't even have the answer to this. And I remember thinking, okay, Was this Murphy's Chinese Laundry?
Or was it Fitzgerald's?
Right. What's the story here? I could probably find out when this laundry was in business. If I can put Murphy at the scene, I can tell this story that either very definitely happened or could have happened. But what I love about it, and what I think a lot of the people who collect these things love about it, is this. It's almost like a poem. It's this tiny moment in time that's been preserved. My job is to construct that poem out of these, you know, almost like a word puzzle. I know I'm digressing so much. I've almost lost it myself.
No, except that what's really interesting about it, this is what I wonder, because you have to, in collecting this sort of thing, or in creating the narrative, which is what you do, or the poem, you've got to know... There's always good, better, best. You know, there are levels of quality. So if you buy the script, for example, you know, I'm trying to figure out where, if you buy the script for one of the Dukes of Hazzard episodes, is that as been signed by the director? That's as valuable to somebody, I suppose,
exactly,
as somebody else's racing you know, Lords of the Turf or whatever, signed by an obscure trainer from...
Uruguay.
Yeah, exactly. That wouldn't normally... even when you're putting these together, I'm sure there are bits that don't exactly match up,
That happens often, and sometimes it's as simple as... Funny you should mention scripts. I have a pile of movie scripts, some to very famous movies, including the first Star Trek film, which I think was in 79, Star Trek the Motion Picture. But then I have some, like, Columbia B movies from the 30s, meaning produced at the Columbia Studio, with no one in them, not even, like, a C, just not Joan Blondell's neighbor.
Not even
neighbor.
B, you know,
right.
Like, we're... Except
so,
that...
But it's still, like, I look at it and I think, oh, it has a value for a number of reasons, not the least of which is... It's still an original movie script that was used on that lot with those same kind of cast of characters, not only the cameramen, but some of those actors, some of those bit players. It is a piece of Hollywood history. You can read a book about David O. Selznick and Gone with the Wind and talking about how the script was put together, and then you look at this little cheesy Columbia script, and it's still all the same stuff they're talking about, whether it's blue pages or the annotations, and... I think it's educating either a public that doesn't know why that's interesting and or of value, or to your point, if I get the Dukes of Hazzard script that is signed by Boss Hogg, is finding the sort of person who sees the value in that. Because to me, it's as interesting and unique as anything else like it, regardless of the milieu, but it's finding the person who thinks... I'm a huge fan. I can't remember the actor who played Boss Hogg.
Right, but it's matching.
It's
matching the item to the individual, which is the key to successful commerce in a funny way.
Oh, not even in a funny way. It happens to me all the time. I pick up a book and I think, okay, it's interesting. It's this. It's that. But most importantly, who do I think of when I grab it? And I don't know what the exact ratio is. It's a good one. I will contact the person in my mind that I think would want this book, and let's say 8 times out of 10, they say, yeah, that's great, it's perfect, because what I'm doing is I'm getting into their head, I'm thinking about all the stuff that we've ever talked about in the past that they've bought for me, that they've told me they bought, and thinking, this seems to fit into your wheelhouse, to coin a phrase, and people respond to it, and they also like to be remembered, like, wow, I didn't know that you remembered I was into single ski water skiing, and here you've got a pamphlet about water skiing on Lake Memphremagog between the two world wars or something like that. So it's this, and we always talk about, it's a bit of Santa Claus, it's a bit of Sherlock Holmes, and it's a bit of adoption agency placement, like, okay, I've got this Dukes of Hazzard script and I know there's someone out there. And then you look at things like eBay and you think, okay, that's a fantastic forum for looking at the collectible world of Dukes of Hazzard in this case, or 1970s television shows. Or the other day I was in a shop in Manhattan, a comic store, and I was there with my son and he was looking for a specific comic, and I noticed that in one of their display cases they had a bunch of toys, and they had vintage Star Trek toys from the 60s and the 70s and some Star Wars stuff. And then they had this series of toys that I had in the late 70s that I've never seen on the secondary market. Never seen them in a charity shop, never seen them on eBay, never seen them in a shop. Never. And there they were, all these figurines and their vehicles. And I said to the guy, I said, and they're called Adventure People. That was the name they traded under. I said, is there like a market that I didn't know about? And he said, no. He said, it's very recently. They're just, people are starting to refer to them and they're showing up. So for some reason, which I don't know yet, Adventure People are now on the map. And it was, I mean, not only was it sort of nostalgic for me to see these things I haven't seen in 40 years, but to see this market sort of developing. You know, was it some guy with the largest collection of Adventure People in the world who was trying to create a market and sort of let things out, which
and
often happens?
You have to ask that question because that's, and you know, I noticed it happening with what is referred to now as mid-century modern furniture. Suddenly, things that you smashed into as a kid growing up. And this is what's so amazing to me about antiques, and because you've got the same thing generationally. It's just half the time the consumers are your ancestors. But they had, again, this is just, but they had the same moment. Like, what is this? This is my grandmother's dining table that people are paying in, you know, obviously in good condition, because a lot of money for, but this was just the regular, like, yeah, we had, and again, live long enough, and then the same cycle repeats going forward.
And if you are in the trades, like I am and you've been, you know about lots of other cycles that precede you. It's not just the one that you live through. It's knowing that your great-grandparents who were buying stuff in 1905 were part of the, let's say, colonial revival waves. They were buying all of this colonial revival stuff, perhaps as well as vintage. So you now have their 100-year-old furniture, but it's not really valuable because it's still in the style of. It's not original. And with, you know, to bring it back to books, sometimes I'll go to someone's house and they'll say, we've got thousands of books. You know, my parents just died. They're in their 90s. And they're convinced there's nothing there of value. And all I will often say, they lived long enough that there's a high probability that they bought something of no value that is now of value simply because it's 50, 70, 80, 100 years old. And we need to find that thing. Or we need to find out that they thoroughly went through their stuff over the years and got rid of everything of that was possibly of value, which I also see. I was in an estate recently where there was thousands of books, maybe 8,000 books, which is a lot of books. That's a house full of books. And I went through with a colleague and we separately discovered and shared with each other that there really wasn't a thing of value in the house. There was a huge percentage of might-have-beens and also-rans, but everything that could have possibly been the cherries on the top of all of these collections were all gone. And it was clear that they had been sold, perhaps to fund the greater collection. Maybe it was 500 books of huge value, which turned into 12,000, or excuse me, 8,000 of much less value. And maybe all that person wanted was the, not the quantity so much as the material in them. You know, I'd rather have 50 books on India than one extremely rare book on India, because those 50 books are going to give me something that the one couldn't. So it was interesting how we looked at each other quizzically, like, what's wrong with this picture?
And where did they went somewhere, but it's also, and we're going to run out of time, but basically, you both knew that they had to have been there at some point.
Right. They were
simply by their absence.
Exactly, their absence. But, you know, I look back, I've collected things throughout my life, and I remember things that I had and sold, and sometimes sold for a huge amount of money at the time. Like we all, anyone who owned property in New York and doesn't anymore thinks about if I'd only held on to it. But of course, if you had, everything else that came after wouldn't have worked. So all the things that I sold, records, instruments, memorabilia. Like I went into a shop the other day and they were selling vintage concert t-shirts for a minimum of $100. And I think of the zillions of those that my mother threw out, like baseball cards. And I'm trying to get my head around, would I buy another one for $100? Or is that just yesterday's news? I'll leave that for someone younger who didn't live through it, and I'll perhaps look to something else.
It's Darren Winston's book report.
Thanks, Darren.